Welcome to Juno Afternoon. You can give yourself a pat on the back for making it all the way to Friday. I'm Rhonda McBride, and for me, the reward is being here with you to top off the week with a little conversation. Ahead, a pulse on the upcoming tourism season, why the independent traveler is more important than ever. And we'll take a look at the menu for this year's Juno Jazz and Classics Festival. Zuhl Bailey will join us to give us a taste of all the musical fare that's available to indulge in. And Juno Audubon Society says there are three birds to keep a lookout for this weekend. But as far as bird watching goes, kind of a wet weekend ahead of us. Tonight, cloudy with scattered showers, lows around 39 degrees. Tomorrow, more rain, highs around 49. Juno Afternoon will be right back after National Native News. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Thank you for joining us on this Friday. I'm Rhonda McBride. We are headed into another tourism season of unknowns, and people like Liz Perry from Travel Juno have been busy all winter trying to figure out how to turn the lemons into lemonade. Liz is president and CEO of Juno Travel, an organization that focuses on promoting independent travel to Juno. Hello, Liz, and maybe a good way to start off might be to talk about just what's a typical independent traveler?
Well, what we're finding is that a lot of our independent travelers are actually kind of are skewing female. There's a lot of interest in solo travel right now. And they vary in age. I would say that, we have interest in virtually all age groups, and there's a continuing interest in multi-generational travel. These are people who enjoy soft adventure, some hard adventures, so people who really like technical hikes, mountain climbing, those kinds of activities. But they also are sophisticated travelers too. So they enjoy art, they enjoy food, they enjoy history. So Juno has all of those in spades. We also know from research that our independent visitors are looking for outdoor spaces. They are looking at national parks to go to. They really want to get off the beaten path for their vacations and for their family.
So they are looking for an authentic experience.
Absolutely. This is not typically a crowd that, I mean, they may enjoy Disneyland, for example, for a variety of reasons, but they want experiences that are off the beaten path, that represent the community well, that they can immerse themselves in. So they're not looking for experiences that were built for tourists. They want to enjoy communities and regions very authentically. They want to immerse themselves in them.
So, how big of a hit did this independent traveler sector of tourism get hit last year?
It got hit significantly, just like all traveler sectors did. We did see a trickle of folks in town, mostly visiting friends and family, but we also had some people who came in to take advantage of fishing lodges, remote lodges, do some camping and those kinds of activities. So I would say that we overall, we were probably down 90 to 95%.
That's huge. How about this year? You have a lot of things happening. Our COVID numbers are declining for the most part. More people are vaccinated. Are you ready to say that there's a light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, we're ready to say that we believe are ready for some visitors to get things reopened. We know from some anecdotal evidence that many of our properties are seeing an uptick in reservations, especially, again, those remote properties of fishing lodges. Some of them are booked solid through the end of the summer and already booking into 22. Some of our B&Bs and smaller properties are tending to fill up a little bit faster, but we're hearing that some of our larger hotels are also seeing some an uptick in reservations, especially toward the end of the summer.
So what are you hearing about the Baranoff? How is it doing? You think that it'll open soon?
It's our understanding that the Baranoff will open right around the first part of June, maybe June 15th, be open for the summer, depending on what reservations look like for the shoulder season and into January. They may or may not remain open for the shoulder season and fall. I believe it is their intent to reopen in January for session, but again, that's in flux and will depend upon what their reservations overall look like.
I bet the downtown businesses are glad to hear that they plan to open soon, at least for the summer.
Yes, absolutely. We, the Baranoff is a great property for business travelers, and we want the very best for them because they are an important piece of our downtown hotel inventory.
And you're going to need that, I guess, if you get independent travelers in, as you hope. Now, one of the things on the horizon that is interesting is because so far as we know, we don't have the big cruise ships coming in the main lines, but it looks like we could see more small cruise ships. Is that the case?
Well, we're seeing that the small ships are still planning to come in as scheduled, which is great. So I don't think it's so much a case of more small ships at this point as it is them maintaining the schedule that they've already established. As a matter of fact, I just looked out my window and saw I believe it's the Safari Adventurer head down the channel, which was a beautiful sight. We're wishing them a great trip.
So I understand that there may be some problems for the smaller cruise ships that want to come here, especially if they want to leave Washington State with passengers. Is that a serious cloud on the horizon?
Well, it is a difficult problem, especially for lines like American Cruise Lines and even Lindblad, with the Port of Washington not allowing passenger ships to leave the Port of Washington loaded. That is a huge hurdle for those lines. So that is one reason I believe Uncruise decided to move some ships to Juneau so that they could embark directly in Alaska. So that required them to get folks on Alaska Airlines, bring them into town, get the testing done, and get them on board ship. That big logistical lift for Uncruise to get that done, but they're getting it done.
So that could bring some changes in the future. I mean, you could hope that maybe they like operating out of Juneau.
Well, absolutely. Uncruise is a great partner with Travel Juneau, and they do good work. They're popular. And for our part, because their guests stay in town either before or after the cruise, that makes them essentially independent travelers. So anyone who does spend the night in town gets that designation one way or the other. So we really welcome the prospect of having Uncruise and other small ships locate into Juneau.
That is such an interesting development this year. It'll be an interesting time, don't you think, to watch that, because we won't have the large cruise ships. So we'll get to see what it's like with just the small cruise ships. Are there any things that you're interested in finding out?
Well, I mean, we are watching that small ship schedule pretty closely, and we're going to be, really watching airport numbers and trying to capture hotel occupancy as best we can, just to gauge how many independent travelers we've got coming in this summer. We're doing a big fourth quarter push through Travel Juneau throughout the U.S. So we're doing any area that is within a reasonably short drive to Seattle and that airport, SeaTac, so the Pacific Northwest. West Coast, California. We are also targeting Dallas-Fort Worth, Eastern Texas, Chicago, and we're also seeing some interest in Juneau from the East Coast, especially in the New York area. So we've got some targeted campaigns going for that to really drum up some interest in Juneau as a destination.
So do you think that Juneau's fairly low COVID numbers and the high rate of vaccination could actually be an incentive for tourists to come here? Maybe the perception that this is a safer place and some of the outdoor experiences would not subject them to COVID infections?
that certainly is playing into the decision that visitors are making. And again, the research is showing that they look to organizations like Travel Juno for evidence that the cities and the destinations are doing everything they can to keep their citizens and visitors safe. So that played into our Juno Cares program that we ran earlier this year. It continues to have legs. That was supported by a grant from the City and Borough of Juno. And we will be using that again this summer. We know that visitors are looking for that information, so we have it front and center on our website so that they can easily see what the city is doing in terms of COVID mitigation.
I know a big chunk of your business is conventions, which is kind of tourism, but it's a special kind of tourism, and I imagine that kind of went through the floor since last year.
That has really been a struggle for us, just for the reasons you mentioned. COVID, of course, took out everything for a number of months. Then, of course, we saw that increase in virtual events and people working remotely and participating remotely. We do have a couple of meetings that are going to be happening this fall. The Alaska Broadcasters Association will be meeting in Juneau for the very first time in November. And we're waiting to hear back from the Alaska Bar Association for their September meeting. They're still working on whether they want to do that virtually or have a hybrid, for example. So as we move into this period where we are seeing a lot of pent-up demand for face-to-face meetings and as well as hybrid meetings. So that is something that's top of mind as we approach planners, throughout the U.S. So our convention sales manager is keeping that top of mind when talking to planners, letting them know what's available in Juno. And we're finally getting planners to say yes to Juno because they too are looking for off the beaten areas for their attendees.
So that's very interesting. But as companies learn that they could very inexpensively compared to live locations put on a convention, do you think that it will be hard to go back to what the convention business was before?
Well, I think it's going to take a little bit to recover. However, what we're finding from association research, the groups that do meet regularly, is that a lot more happens with face-to-face meetings. And if when you go to conferences, when you go to conventions, the side conversations that you have, the networking that you're able to do, and just decisions that can be made. If it's a business meeting, are a lot easier to do if you're face-to-face. They're just more productive. Those networks get tighter, and they're just more enjoyable and more work gets done. So we believe that face-to-face will see a rebound probably in the next year or so, and meeting planners are telling us they're ready to commit to face-to-face meetings again. So, with that, all that said, we need to make sure that we're safe and we've got space for them, and also that we have our event numbers are such that we fit into whatever space the City and Borough of Juno say we need to be in for their COVID safety mitigation plans.
Well, there's a lot of excitement right now around plans to expand Centennial Hall to make room for a new Juno Arts and Humanities Council Center. There is also talk about perhaps being able to tap into federal money that's being made available as far as kind of a national infrastructure rebuild. And I know that the convention industry is very interested in expanding Centennial Hall. And of course, the slogan has been in some of these infrastructure funding, federal funding questions, is build back and build better. So what are your thoughts about being able to perhaps build something better for your tourism and convention industry?
Well, one thing we want to really make clear to everyone in Juneau, all of our residents, is that the concepts that the city is considering right now put arts pieces together with convention pieces under one roof, under one civic center that is city owned. So that's a real important distinction to make, is that we're not talking two separate pieces that are being kind of joined together. This will be one unified facility. And what we're hearing from planners is that they need additional meeting room space to break out even groups of 250 to 300 people. And we don't have that in Centennial Hall right now. And really a meeting of 300 people is not that big. So we're really excited to be part of the working group to get these pieces together and work with the Arts and Humanities Council to make sure that we've got the traffic patterns figured out. We've got the spaces that we actually need. And we just held two public meetings to get all of that done. So, to get public input, we're really looking forward to seeing how the architects put those pieces together for us and what they come up with for the assembly.
As far as the component of maybe building back and building better, some of that thinking right now, as far as infrastructure goes, if you could build it better, what would you do? Besides sharing and working together to make something happen, which is huge, but in your mind, what could be done to make conventions here in Juneau even more robust and appealing to people to come here and have them?
I think it's a function of having the right spaces, the right finishes, having an appealing building that is beautiful both inside and out, and that takes advantage of the views from that lot up to the mountains and across the water. So what we have learned from the architects and engineers is that Centennial Hall on the backside, I guess, along Willoughby, is actually engineered for a second story. So the opportunity to build up that second story, put meeting rooms up there, and take advantage of that roof line would really make an appealing building. Our big vision is that that building is being used as much as possible for multiple functions, so that we have multiple groups meeting in there at any given time. It's incredibly busy. It's beautiful when visitors walk by it. They want to come back and have a meeting there.
Well, in this time of COVID, where we spend hours and hours and hours and hours on Zoom, you have to wonder if companies have discovered some advantages to this. So do you expect that putting on conventions will also require an investment in technology for hybrid events?
Absolutely. And of course, that is something that, part of that has happened and it continues to happen with the current round of renovations that is happening at Centennial. But we want to make sure that that facility is, as technologically advanced as we can get it, knowing that a hybrid meeting is probably the wave of the future. We just need to prepare for that. But we want to also make sure that there's plenty of room for the face-to-face interactions that we know meeting attendees really want to have.
Yeah, and I think it'll be interesting going forward what evolves, because I instinctively don't feel that it's going to be the same as it was. Do you, Liz?
Well, when you say it won't be the same, do you mean the meeting experience or the facility?
I think the meeting experience for people that technology is going to become a bigger part of these meetings, even if they are in person.
That's true, because we're still going to be relying and using more heavily technology just to make presentations. I mean, just think about how we have moved into beautiful presentations on many different kinds of platforms to make the experience much, much easier and much more rich for attendees. So looking forward to what these platforms are going to be and being prepared to get them implemented is part of what we're doing with the hall plans right now. We want to be prepared for whatever planners really require for their meetings.
Well, when we come up with our next segment, we're going to be talking about a hybrid event that is a combination of virtual and in-person, the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival coming up later this month. So I guess we're already headed down that path, it looks like it.
Yeah, and we really look forward to, you know, seeing how all of these plans shake out, and we definitely appreciate being part of the process and working collaboratively with Arts and Humanities Council.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Liz Perry, for being here to give us an update on the travel industry and to get a sense of how you are going to navigate as we wind our way out of this pandemic. Liz Perry, Executive Director for Travel Juno, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
The sounds of Zool Bailey and his cello to get us ready for our visit with him coming up, as well as Sandy Fortier, who heads up the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival. So enjoy, and we'll be visiting with Zool shortly. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Well, starting on May 24, some amazing opportunities to enjoy classics and jazz to tell you about. Zool Bailey is the festival's artistic director, a new hat for him, also director of the Sitka Summer Music Festival. We also have Sandy Fortier with us today. She's the festival's director, but I suspect that part of Sandy's job is to keep Zool Bailey in line, right, Zool?
That's not a good way to start an interview, Rhonda.
Well, I know that that you are just always traveling all around the world and doing different things and as busy as ever, wearing so many hats. So I know that it's probably hard for you to work all of this in. Seems like this table is being set for a wonderful feast. And Sandy, I wanted to ask you about the tickets because I understand that they are now on sale and some of the events could go very quickly.
Yes, they actually we just sold out our first concert. Putting on the Ritz is sold out, but the rest of them do have tickets. But the way we're having to do the festival this year to keep everybody safe and follow COVID protocols is we're about 50% capacity at all the venues. But we decided to do two shorter concerts, so it kind of makes up for the difference. But yeah, tickets are on sale and they're going fast.
So, Zool, this year you have sort of a hybrid event where you've got a mix of the virtual and in-person. Are you excited about that, some of the opportunities that it might afford? Because I think that Midori is going to be giving a recital and a workshop.
This is the way of the future, Rhonda. This is not just an experiment. This is what we'll probably be doing and most organizations will be doing for the foreseeable future. We're able to reach so many more people. We're able to document performances to stream other times. We're able to access the community via education, as well as when we can't get certain artists from around the world. One of the luxuries about being a traveling musician, as I am, is seeing how organizations are able to traverse this pandemic. We are very lucky that we all learned a lot of tools and gathered a lot of tools to not only throughout the years, but our footprint has grown. In addition to that, we've created an educational component for visiting artists virtually to go into the schools. So we just kind of had to put a few things on hold this past year because of just the travel restrictions. But we've certainly had an amazing impact on Juno throughout the entire year. And I've been able to come up several times, as you know, to get ready for this epic week, which starts with a Kennedy Center Award winner, Midori, who's giving a special presentation for us for the first few days of our week. In addition, while she's doing that virtually, Jason Dio, the Grammy Award-winning guitarist, is coming in to play not only solo concerts for us and a new work by Pat Metheny, which he wrote for Jason, but he will be joining me in duo presentations, community engagement going to the schools, and outdoor concerts. And to top off all of that, and you know, just this is just a few days we're in, we get to celebrate the brand new recording that I have made of the Bach cello suites that I recorded during this pandemic in Mesa, Arizona. The exceptional thing about this recording is that it was recorded 175 times that of a CD. It's going to be in super audio, at DSD, unlike anything anyone's ever heard before. And preparing for that recording changed my interpretation of the suites, which is what I did in Juno about 12 years ago. Amazing how long I've been coming to Juno annually, and to be now the artistic director, it's kind of like it's fate, because I know the city so well, and I admire your founder, Linda Rosenthal, so much. And I spend months a year in Alaska now. And so you asked how to keep me in line. Well, it's more how to get me out of the state, because every time I come to Alaska, I want to stay. And the festivals and things that I work for, especially Alaska, they are my priority. I really feel making a difference in communities is primary. And the only way to really do that is to have consistency and a consistent approach to being visible throughout the entire year.
I don't know how you do it. Like, you are talking to us now from your home in Texas.
Yes.
Before this conversation, you were doing a Zoom concert.
I was giving a presentation to young children in the barrio here in El Paso, Texas, and on the border into Mexico right before this. And it's an amazing time. And to be very honest, what the pandemic has made me want to do is to travel less and spend more time in the communities that I have invested so much in. And, of course, that's Alaska. It's an amazing feeling, and I feel like it's going to be a renaissance, this next chapter. It's nothing to be scared about.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you about, you are rolling out your new album, your Bach cello suites, and I understand that you've been scoping out the locations that you're going to perform, and one of the locations is the Klan House in the Walter Soboloff building, a beautiful cedar building. What was the sound like?
We walked in that building, and we heard the sound of the cello and the intimacy of the wood and the resonance of the space. It was as if I was sitting inside my cello. And we couldn't believe the sound, and we couldn't believe it was so perfect for this celebratory few days to celebrate the Bach cello suite. But also, this is the first time that I will have a festival where I'm the new artistic director, so I get to make it highly, highly personal. We have multiple presentations of these. Some will be playing a lot of the suites. Some of them will be playing my favorite movements of the suites. But the most important thing is that we're going to all be together and be very safe. And there'll be a lot of options for people to hear these as well in free outdoor concerts in different settings, because we, as an organization, own a carbon fiber cello now. So I'm able to go out and play by the whale all downtown, as well as Jason Vio, the wonderful guitarist. So it's going to be a very, very full week. And as Sandy said, tickets are selling very well, and partially because people are really wanting to hear live music. But we're trying to add as many events as possible because they're going to be intimate occasions and very safe.
As someone standing in the Klan House hearing you play your cello, Sandy, tell me what it was like to hear a cello played in that room of beautiful wood.
Oh, yeah, I'm the lucky one who got to test that out with him. I feel like I don't know where exactly the best spot is. It's right below the cello. And I was saying to the other person who was there that that's $1 million seat right there. It really does feel like you're inside the cello. It just does. It's perfect for Zool to play in.
Zool, I'm curious about some of the locations for this concert, because you're going to have Jason Vio do a workshop out of a chapel by Auk Lake. So many interesting settings. Do you have settings like this in other communities that you work out of?
There's no place like Alaska. There's no place like El Paso, Texas. You know, the thing that makes these places so special is the uniqueness and the incredible fingerprint that makes them what they are. What Juno has to offer, only Juno has to offer. And one of the things that we're trying to do in this interesting week is we're trying to move people around and maybe even showcase places that even living there, they don't frequent. But the instruments that we are bringing in are very mobile. Obviously, with the use of a piano, you have to pick something that is piano friendly, and you have to get a piano. But a single guitar, or a guitar and cello, and or a solo cello, or a virtual presentation by a Kennedy Center Award winner for us is something that is, again, extraordinary. I am so proud of this week and getting people around, getting people together, and celebrating this next chapter.
Well, it is an interesting chapter because Jason Vio, I'm reading the write-up that's on the Juno Arts and Classic website, that NPR has deemed him as perhaps the most precise and soulful classical guitarist of his generation.
I would say, in addition to whatever accolades he is as a musician, he is one of the coolest dudes I've met. And he loves guitar, and he loves playing all different styles. This was one of the things that was kind of the twist for me. And obviously the jazz element to Juno Jazz and Classics is so special and so singularly unique. And Jason was the perfect foil for this because he plays world music. He plays jazz things on guitar. He plays tangos. He plays, I mean, again, from all over the globe. But when I described the canvas that is Juno Jazz and Classics, he said, "That's a dream." And I love that answer because it's basically he can play anything. And the fact is that when you win a Grammy like he did, I think it was 2014, he won over all instruments. He won over cellists. He won over violinists. He won over pianists. He was celebrated as the number one performer that year as a guitarist. And that says a lot. And to have him in Juno playing basically world music and taking us a tour around the world. And then, of course, as I was saying before, and I'll say it again because it's unbelievable, that we have a Kennedy Center Award honoree the day before also playing for us. We basically have the world's best that entire week. And so when you hear Jason play, you've got simply the best.
I'm curious about guitar and cello because both of you in your repertoire have a lot of Bach. And it's very interesting because with a cello, you can draw out sounds. Or if you play Bach on a piano, you can use the pedal to extend and make sound swell. But on a guitar, you really can't do that.
Well, I'll tell you a little secret. One of the most revelatory things that I've ever had happen on how to play Bach on the cello was hearing Bach played on the guitar. When I was trying my best to figure out how to play Bach without it sounding like a cellist trying to play Bach, I realized that the issue was the bow. Because you're having to roll chords, you're having to do things with this bow that is, it's a slightly unnatural thing. Yes, we can sustain, but we can't hit chords squarely. We can't voice like a piano can. You realize Bach's instrument was the organ. So he could actually bring certain notes out in the chords, but play them solidly. Cellists have to navigate that, or navigate not being able to do that. And the moment I heard Segovia and Julian Breen and other wonderful guitarists play, and to bring out inner notes that took the ear a certain direction, because the bow wasn't involved, it all of a sudden, it's as if like I was looking at the world with different colors. It's a magnificent comparison. In fact, I hope that he plays some Bach in his concerts, because then we can really hear the contrast between a bowed instrument and a plucked instrument. I think there's no more glorious instrument, of course, other than the cello, to play Bach than a guitar.
Somehow I knew you were going to say
that. That week in May, you're going to feel our presence, and we're back. So we can't wait to see everybody soon, face-to-face. In whatever capacity people would like to hear concerts, we will present them to you.
Well, we are just about out of time, and I just wanted to give Sandy Fortier a chance to take care of some unfinished business. Sandy, what do we need to know to take part in this?
Well, the full schedule and all the information you need is on our website, which is jazzandclassics.org, all spelled out. We have indoor, outdoor, free, ticketed. We have things at Twin Lakes, down at Sandy Beach, Chapel by the Lake.
And thank you for a great afternoon, Rhonda.
All right. Thank you. It was great to chat with you. And thank you, Sandy, for helping us put this together. Appreciate it very much. Well, we are going to hear a flute sonata with Jason Viau. It's going to lead into our next interview about where to go to see three very interesting birds that have returned to Juneau. Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Earlier in the show, we talked about tourism, and our next guests are here to talk about another kind of Juneau visitor, the migratory birds that stop here to feed and raise their young. And joining me now, Gwen Bayless and Lizzie Solger. They're both from the Juneau Audubon Society, and it is prime time for bird watching. And Gwen, I know that you're out and about, and the last time we talked, you were checking out the Arctic terns. Have you had any other observations about them?
Yeah, they're starting to settle into their nesting area out by the visitor center, which is really exciting. I didn't mention last time, for those that follow the tern colony out there, which has been around for a long time, almost 100 years actually, that they had a really great year last year. Sometimes I do articles and the success is not very good that year, and it's a little bit depressing, but we had a lot of young last year, so it was really great.
So I've got a bit of sound so you can hear what a tern sounds like, so I will play it. It's not the most pleasant sound, is it?
I guess pleasant is in the ear of the beholder, but no, for as cool as they are, their vocalization is not really what people like.
Let's hear. Yeah, I guess, but you got to give them credit for how far they travel to get here. So, Lizzie, what have you been looking out for lately?
Well, as the trees are starting to develop leaves, I'm trying to see every little bird that's normally hard to see in the summer while they're still visible. So the little sparrows and the warblers, and just keep an eye on them before they disappear from sight.
I guess that is the challenge, is you want the greenery, but then it makes it easier for the birds to hide. Now, I understand that there are two birds that we were going to focus on this week to let people know about, and one of those is the varied thrush and the hermit thrush. And can you tell us a little bit about where we might be able to spot those birds?
Well, the varied thrush it's about the size of a robin, and it's got that pretty orange and black pattern on it, and you'll probably hear them before you see them. Any former jocks will recognize the gym class whistle that is their call, and I think you'll play it for folks in a second.
Now, the other kind of thrush, and I'm going to play this real quick, the hermit thrush is much more melodic. So one of the things that we should tell people about before we run out of time, and we've got just about a minute or so here, is that this is a big week for birding. Tomorrow is your big birdathon. What happens with that?
Yeah, so this is a really exciting event for us. It's an opportunity for folks to get out birding and count as many birds as they can in their local area. We hope that folks from all over Southeast Alaska will participate. And then we're going to tally up how many bird species we get. And hopefully some folks will sponsor us with some donations, either buy the bird or a set amount. And this will support Juneau Audubon Society and will be split with the Southeast Alaska Food Bank. And the best way to find out more is our website, JuneauAudubonSociety.org, or our Facebook page.
So Lizzie, how much do you personally hope to raise?
As much as we can. The food bank is such an important resource for our community. And so it's great to be able to support that while supporting citizen science.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us, Elizabeth Solger and Gwen Bayless. Thanks so much for telling us about that, and good luck with your birdathon.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for Juneau Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klinkit & Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JuneauAfternoon.
And that will do it for Juneau Afternoon. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Have a great weekend.